Welcome to One Big Church Radio, the podcast for church leaders everywhere. You are now part of a group of underground pastors and thought leaders passionately trying to change the world one person at a time. But because we don't rely on unlimited budgets, we have to think differently. We have to create new ideas together, and we do this by joining together as one to help you be found online and funded. This podcast will give you a glimpse into the daily life of pastors going through the exact same things you face every day. Hey guys, Barclay here at One Big Church, and today I'm excited to share an incredibly interesting conversation that I had with Marion Clifton. So his mission is to spread the message of Jesus Christ to Arabs. Take a listen to how he's doing it and the advice that he shares towards the end on things that he's learned that I know can help you with your mission work as well.
My name is Marion Clifton. I oversee Arab World Outreach, and Arab World Outreach is simply just an organization. We kind of call ourselves a global community or a global movement because we really want to stir a movement of disciples who are genuinely making disciples, who are reaching out to different communities. And the reason we specifically say Arab World Outreach is because we're focusing on the Arab world, obviously. We're located in Dearborn, Michigan, which is the largest concentration of Arabs outside of the Arab world. And so our mission, our official mission statement is to help people follow Jesus for the good of the Arab world. So a lot of times, one of the things we like to say is it's incredibly challenging to come in and say our goal is to make converts, because what happens is that is all over your website. When you say, hey, we're a church planting organization, this is what we do, this is who we are, and it brands you as someone that is not appealing to non-believers. It's not appealing to the Arab world. A lot of times, I guess we've done church planting in churched contexts in the world. I think it is like 3 to 5%, like less than 3 to 5% of church funds actually goes to unengaged communities. So a lot of our research then is kind of geared towards the church world. So we're focused very much so on the Arab world because less than 6% of the population follow Jesus. And the majority of those live in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, places like that. There are also communities in Egypt, and really there's a Christian presence in every single Arab country that we know of. But from what we know, the majority of Arab countries do have a Christian presence. And so one of the things we want to do is mobilize Christians first and foremost to engage all spheres of society within the Arab world, to engage it, to be genuine disciples who make disciples. And I think that's what's going to bring a lot of transformation.
So planting a church is hard to begin with in the States. How in the world are you doing this in these countries? A lot of things come to mind. Security is a major one. And I know that that's something that you're kind of going back and you're dealing with.
I recently met with a man named Bob Roberts. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. A phenomenal guy, phenomenal resource. And one of the things he said is if you start with church planting as a focus specifically in a majority Muslim context, you're not going to end up anywhere. Some cases you might because you get lucky or you find people who are ready to hear this message. But in most cases, you're just going to ruin your reputation and you're going to ruin your ability to actually get into a country. And one of the things I had a hunch of, but when he said it to me, it made a lot, like it reconfirmed it, because I've been to a couple Arab countries, but I'm not regularly in and out of there. We're focusing a lot in Dearborn to try to kind of mobilize people from here to reach their own countries. And when I spoke with him, he said he doesn't believe in closed countries. And I agree with that wholeheartedly because there's security issues, there's challenges. You're going to find people who are really traditional, really conservative. Even I'm familiar with people who've run into contact with extremists before. Like, those are real scenarios. But the reality is, if you start with the head first, like start with like talking about Jesus and pointing out to convert people first and foremost, you're going to face a lot of challenges and a lot of conflict. But if you start with the hand, just reaching out a hand and saying, how are you? How can I help you? How can I serve your community? No one's going to refuse that. In fact, some communities have never had that. Mm-hmm. One of the things it was a couple months ago, actually, I met with the imam at the Islamic Center of America. And I was like, how can I serve this community? How can we not be a sore, like, in the wound of things like Islamophobia and all of these different types of things that you're dealing with as a community? How do we help? he said, one of the huge thing is like, what if we brought congregations together, both my Muslim congregation and the church connections that I know of, how do we bring them together to serve our community, to benefit the community together? And then, like, for example, in Islam, dawah is the same thing as evangelism, essentially. They have the same concept. So we were like, what if we brought them together to actually do something good and positive in the community, but also gave them lots of opportunities to share faith with one another and to really genuinely start to have that conversation?
So that's interesting, because something that we talked about was you're really, in an essence, trying to convert each other, right? Because you're bringing, when you're talking to the imam, he has his religion, and then there's Christianity. So how are you blending the two to make that work and it's genuine?
Yeah, so one of the things is there's this movement that kind of synchronizes the two together, which I am not for at all. It's kind of like it's essentially mixing the religions together. And I am anti that, completely anti that. I'm 100% Bible-based. We're all about what the Bible says. And there's these dialogues out there that they call interfaith dialogues, where Muslim clerics and Christian clerics will come together, or different leaders will come together from these faiths and talk about common issues. But they usually talk about flowery, high-level stuff. They talk about the commonalities, things they agree on. But one of the things Bob Roberts is all about, and I'm all about, I just keep saying Bob Roberts just because the phone call I had with him the other day, he's kind of like, just encouraged me and motivated me to continue to pursue this idea, because he thinks it's valid and it works. And that's what I've seen too, is that what if we got together, we genuinely talked about our faith, and even though we genuinely disagree with each other, that's irrelevant. What if we loved each other in spite of those differences, and we began to actually build valid relationships, and we were here long term? Like, I had a good Muslim friend. He saw my website, Arab World Outreach's website, I think it was about a month ago, and he's actually challenged me, because I was sitting, we were at an Indian restaurant having food, and he said, so I was looking at your website, is your goal to convert me? And like, my heart just sunk. Like, I didn't really know how to respond, because it was kind of awkward, and you could just feel the tension, kind of. And then I began to explain the Great Commission, what it says. I explained how we need to make disciples. We're called to eventually plant churches and these types of things as believers. And they have a similar kind of concept in Islam. And then also, we're called to love our neighbors as ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's a great commandment. So we have this great commandment and a great commission. And I believe in like marrying them together and not separating them ever in any context. So I was explaining that to him, and he challenged, like, we ended up adjusting our website to make it not feel like an agenda. I don't want to sit down with a Muslim friend or an Arab Chaldean or whatever. But I had a friend, there's a minority religion called Mandeanism. I just learned about it the other day. And he's Arab. He's from Iraq. And I don't want to sit down with them and them assume that my goal has an agenda. Mm-hmm. I don't think, even though we're called to make disciples, we're not called to have an agenda. Our agenda is to love them, and our message is Jesus.
And how are you doing this? It's a younger generation. I mean, you're a younger guy. And so you're reaching out to people who have done this kind of church planning work, obviously not to the extent of what you're trying to do, but mission work has changed so much. And one of the things that you said to me earlier was people go to reach, and if they can't reach them, they move on to the next person. How do you switch that mind? How do you change the cultural thinking in that?
Yeah, so I think it's going to be a huge cultural shift in churches, in understanding what needs to be done, especially to reach the unreached, mm-hmm. Or the people who don't have church context. If we go to places like Europe, it's a little different, mm-hmm. Just because like it's similar to American culture, but a little bit farther progressed past like post-Christian culture. But when you go into Arab countries, 90% of these countries are Muslim. So these have been post-Christianity for 1,400 years. So Christian culture hasn't been there for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very much so in Islamic culture. We do missions work, I think, in the church differently than the way we do church. Mm-hmm. So church has started to adjust to culture. We see churches that look more like airports or like malls or these types of places. And these are from these people who sat down and thought, how do we make these places more accessible to people, more comfortable for people, where people can relate to and connect to? So we started asking those questions for the church world, which the church world and the mission world aren't separate. They're one and the same. We're both called to make disciples. One just happens to be in a different context. So we need to start being more innovative and ask different questions in the same way we're asking different questions in the church world. I think one of those things is talking about multi-faith as opposed to interfaith. Mm-hmm. We talked about interfaith there for a second, but multi-faith is saying, I'm going to love you in spite of what I believe and our differences, and we're going to work together because Jesus came to establish a kingdom before he came to establish a church. He did come to establish a church, but when he came, he preached a gospel of the kingdom. He said the kingdom of God is at hand, but he's not been crucified yet. So he's preaching this gospel, and it's a kingdom-minded gospel, and not necessarily directly a salvation gospel. But then after he was crucified, there was a salvation gospel within the church as well. But he began with the kingdom and then led to salvation. And I think as a church, we should do that too. And I think that's the reason we're going into Muslim contexts and we're facing conflict, because we're doing it backwards. And then there's a lot of like stuff about colonialism and stuff that was... Missions and colonialism were tied together for the longest time.
Mm-hmm.
So when we were sent to these places, we were sent to change them the way they dressed. Missionaries sometimes sent back information about the culture. They were anthropologists. They had all of these different hats from the culture that has now branded in the Muslim world what Christians should look like. And a lot of those aren't true.
How are you being received when you tell people what you're doing? What is the immediate reaction, and how do you so quickly overcome that perception that people get when they hear, whoa, what are you doing?
Yeah. So people, when I kind of explain it, they automatically assume I'm a missionary. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of push back on that. I'm not a huge fan of using the term missionary or really using the term Christian in this context, mainly because there's so much baggage that goes with it. So I try to explain everything. So when I say I'm a Christian, I say what that means. When I say that I'm a missionary, I explain I'm a different kind of missionary. I don't necessarily act like the ones you're going to meet on the streets are going to come up to you with the track and try to convince you to believe what we believe, instead of showing you who Jesus is and sharing who Jesus is and just loving you genuinely.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing how that plays out.
What would you say is your biggest obstacle right now in the work that you're doing?
I would say probably fundraising. Mm-hmm. Just because I'm not that skilled, I guess, at fundraising. I'm slowly learning.
Yeah.
Like storytelling and vision casting, and how do you like have scalability and like, I guess, how you get your message out there.
Mm-hmm.
How do you then like connect with churches and all this kind of stuff? I think that's my number one challenge, which I think is a challenge for anyone starting up.
Well, let me say this. So you have, churches get 52 weeks every year to stand in front of their congregation 3-4 times a day on a Sunday for an hour at a time. What would you do, or what would you say to somebody if you had hundreds, sometimes thousands of people in front of you once a week? We talk a lot about it. Pastors get caught up in how do you send the message when people like you would envy that opportunity.
So we have this leading statement that we try to lead everything with when we're talking with Muslims, we're talking with Christians. Really, I think we're discipling both sides sometimes.
Yeah.
Understand what we're doing. And we start with this statement: Jesus loves Arabs. We have bracelets that say it. It's not saying that Jesus doesn't love any other demographic of people, but it's emphasizing the fact that we need to realize that Jesus does love Arabs. It doesn't matter your political view, political opinions. It doesn't matter your background. It doesn't matter if you've never met an Arab. I grew up in a small town in Southern Ohio and had never met an Arab until I got into this work. So it was very new to me. And what led me to it was understanding Jesus's love for all people and the fact that the church wasn't responding to this part of the world, seeing the need. So really, ultimately, it's hard to, I don't want to say that the church has been disobedient. Because we are focusing on making disciples in some capacities, but one of the areas that has been ignored is the Arab world. And we kind of just
Why do you think that is?
I think we clump it into saying that it's challenging. There's going to be persecution. There's going to be people kicked out of countries, or these countries are impossible, or the countries are closed countries, or Muslims are stubborn, or these types of things that we just assume, and they're not true. Mm-hmm. Now, there are challenges. Challenges are real. Persecution happens, but Jesus promised persecution. I think if we're genuinely doing something, like I have a friend of a friend that they were working in Yemen, and the government approached them and said, you're going to have to leave because of what you're doing here. And they were doing like more development work than anything else. But they did want to plant a church eventually. If God would have moved and built like a disciple community there, they wanted to start a church. But their goal was to start with community development. That was their way to serve and get their in with genuinely loving them and sharing the gospel in a tangible way. And so the government showed up, and the people stood in the way of them. So the local elders and people stopped the government and said, no, if you take these people out, they're the only ones helping us. You're not helping us. These people are helping us. These people have served us and made us have a better life. They're an asset to us. You can't take them. And they literally like made the government turn away.
Is it disheartening to you to hear things like that, stories like that? And yet here in America, there are so many churches doing mission work in so many different parts of the world. But that's really not a focus. How do you get people to recognize that?
I started this in 2013, but then had to step away after 6 months because I was just frustrated. I was honestly bitter with the church, and then God ended up leading me to a church in Kentucky where I ended up as a discipleship pastor there. And so there I was for over a year, discipling people, helping people grow, helping people get in small groups and understanding these things. And what I realized was on a day-to-day basis, how much people go through. I mean, they're working, they have kids, they're worried about their finances, they're worried about the medical, but they're worried about all these different types of things. Do they have time? Do they have margin to really even think about what I'm trying to tell them? That's not an excuse for people to cop out of joining a group or serving in the church or giving to missions. But it's just saying these are the real struggles that people face that hinder them from that. And we need to recognize them and learn how to communicate in spite of those things. So when I approach someone, I understand that, and I have to understand they're never going to be as passionate about this as I am. They may already be giving to a work somewhere else that they're incredibly passionate about that God has called them to do. Mm-hmm. I think we have to understand that.
Take me back to 2013 and just tell me what was just some of the most frustrating things that you came across that made you just stop.
I started training with an organization and then ended up stepping aside because I told you a little bit about like how I'm very transparent. Mm-hmm. And I kind of just like openly share stuff and I don't hold back at all. And they were very security focused, which is fine. It's understandable. So I ended up stepping away from that organization. My fundraising efforts were doing awful when I was trying to communicate with churches. One of the things that I was challenged by was how do you get in touch with the church? So I would call a church, and if a church had a secretary, the secretary would answer. Most churches don't. So I would get a voicemail, and people are too busy to call back. So there's not systems and processes in place at a lot of churches for missionaries to contact and to get funding. Or even if that's the case, a lot of churches now are wanting to focus on the region, which is awesome. I love regional folks because I think that's what's going to change the world. But we have this leftover of exceptions where we need to do strategic focuses, which is why we do our work. But I didn't know that I had to stick it out. I didn't know how to communicate or do storytelling or these types of things. And my parents, actually, because I had just come out of college, they ended up supporting me for the majority of the part. I had some money that was from fundraising, but then they helped me quite a bit as well. And I just moved up here, and I was continuing to try to fundraise. Had no idea how to start like a nonprofit or anything like that. So I didn't even know if God was calling me to start a nonprofit, or what exactly do I plant a church? Do I make disciples that go and do that? Do I just have a nonprofit that serves the Arab community? What do I do? So I just didn't have, I guess, the clarity of what God was wanting me to do. So there's just a lot weighing on me. Mm-hmm. And so I think it boils down to connection to churches, I didn't have someone that was mentoring me at the time. I blamed it on the church. I blamed it on others. And I think that's what we kind of want to do sometimes. If God calls us to do something and we don't find success in it, we blame it on others because we assume, well, I get it because God has called me to it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes God's wanting to shape us and grow us.
You obviously kept coming into roadblock after roadblock. And then when you decided to step out and start this nonprofit, from what you've learned in the church, is there something that you would do different to help make it easier for you?
One of the things I do kind of regret is not doing a more of a soft launch of the organization. So do like a soft launch and then a hard launch later on, which I think would have, built some more momentum, got more people involved on the front end. Mm-hmm. So now I am here in Dearborn trying to do ministry hands-on while also fundraising, trying to connect with churches and then doing all of these different types of things and trying to have all these hats on at once.
Tell me about your leadership team.
So we have a board of directors as a nonprofit we're required to. So they all are in different things. And I kind of was looking for people that were passionate, but then also people who had skill sets that we'd be able to utilize. One of them oversees the department at a university. So he had a lot of administrative stuff. I'm not great at administrative skills. So I wanted to surround me around people that had the skill sets that I didn't. I didn't know where I was weak at to bring people in that were stronger at those things. One of the ladies, she's over HR at her organization. And so she's very helpful. And then one was an executive pastor who had experience also as an administrator at a private school. So that was very helpful. But then we also have, just on the ground here, we just have me and my wife. So she is the operations director, which kind of sees like the hands-on stuff of day-to-day, like reoccurring stuff, like handling finances, reconciling the budget. She helps me with different tasks as well. She was a co-founder. And then we're also trying to recruit volunteers now too. So we're in that process of connecting with churches. So we have to have that structure in place as well.
What's your approach now to churches, having been through that frustration? How do you get past the secretary now?
It's a lot slower of a process, which I'm not a patient person, so it's rough still. But I realized like that's how networking works. So it's a lot of networking with key leaders that I already know. Like, for example, the pastor I was under in Kentucky, phenomenal man, has a huge network of people that he knows that he can connect me with, if not for financial support or for volunteers, just for an open ear, just to hear their advice or their ideas. And they might know someone who talked a little bit about maybe a passion for Arabs or unreached people or these different types of things that can connect us with those people. And then locally, I might email people and say, hey, this is who we are. This is who I am. This is who we are. Would love to meet up for coffee. We'll buy your coffee. And I'll just want to hear about what you guys are doing in the community. So I learn kind of what the assets are already present.
I want to talk about the fundraising aspect of this. What does it take for you? I hear the frustration of just fundraising can be a very, very hard thing. What have you learned and what are you doing right now? You have a certain key demographic kind of that you're going after, and also millennials. This is a big hot topic.
Yeah. So like our overall budget is pretty small right now because we're operating on like $90,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty small. But still like not having the network to reach out to people who can, I met with one nonprofit leader and he said the president should focus on finding major donors and the rest should be done at speaking engagements and stuff like that. So say, hey, we accept donations and take those at speaking engagements. But he said the majority of your time should be only spent on major donors that can do like 20,000. Like, I don't know anyone personally in my personal sphere of network, like personal network, that can just drop $20,000. Like, most of my friends aren't making $20,000 a year. I don't have enough money to be able to do that. So we kind of shifted to who is my network right now. I'm going to continue to kind of build that network. But I realize my network right now is millennials. It's people I know that are in college or just post-college or just getting their dream job or what they got their degree in. So there's not a lot of margin because they're still paying off debts for like college and things like that. So we wanted to pull our target donation down. So it's only, we're focusing on like right now, recruiting 1,000 people to give $10 a month, which 1,000 people to give $10 a month, that's 120,000 a year. So that's 30,000 over what we would need to have income. So then we're ready for next year for expansion. And then we can, like, it sets us up for so much more success to see what's next. So that would be our first goal. And then our next goal would be to continue to expand that, maybe look for 10,000 next time and to continue like the scalability of the organization.
Do you find having a system like that in place is very beneficial to what you're doing and how you're doing it?
Absolutely. When we first started, I could just call up someone and talk to them about what we were doing. But like, for example, we just started this campaign and we said it was going to last for 30 days and we're trying to recruit 1,000 people. And we ended up getting like 59 people that joined. And then yesterday I announced, hey, this is going to be part of who we are. We're just going to recruit movement makers. Whenever we go to churches online, we're going to be asking for people, different things like that. I didn't realize how many people I knew until I started contacting people. And so in a week or two's time, I had talked to, I think it was 147 people that are like personal close friends or family members or people I've come in contact with in college or people who are in ministry that I know pretty well. So I contacted all of them personally within a week's time. So that was challenging. So if I didn't have a system for that, I wouldn't have known who I talked to already. I wouldn't have known what their response was. I had to have like process cues ready to go on like, if they say yes, what's next? What's mm-hmm. next process? What email gets sent to them? Do they get sent an email? How do they sign up for the recurring giving? Do they do it online? Do they do it in mail? What if they prefer mail, but you prefer the online? Do you have that process set up? So like thinking ahead and anticipating every single possibility mm-hmm. and to the best of your ability to build that system. But when you come to a system, sometimes I think you can restructure. It's like there were some exceptions. Like I mainly focused on online giving, but then there were some, for example, that wanted to donate in by mail. So like I ended up sending them our address, but I didn't think about that already. So it was like it was a surprise. There was a small stressor there. And the stressor was stupid because it's very small. But like it does stress you out when something comes up that's unexpected, especially when there's so much going on.
Tell me about how you thank your donors.
I think that it's absolutely essential to thank people, and that's one of the number one reasons people don't give. I think that's number one, people don't get involved. I remember working with, because like I wasn't directly over all of our volunteers, but like had to kind of to work with some of our volunteers, like quite a few of them. So we had almost 300 volunteers at one point at the church I was at in Kentucky. And so if we didn't thank them, you could see a drop in retention. So in that same sense, like with donors, if you don't thank them regularly and know what their money is going towards and letting them see the impact of their giving, then they're not gonna know, they're gonna lose interest and they're gonna go away. And then also, like, don't make it about just the money. Actually have a conversation with them. Actually have a relationship. I don't know at what point we would have, like, a donor relations, like, manager. But, like, I think that's important in a lot of organizations as well. Like, actually having those relationships with donors. Knowing what their interests are. Knowing how to connect with them in the best way.
Does it blow your mind to know that there are churches that do not thank their donors?
It doesn't completely. Because I feel like I fell into that. Sometimes when I was at the church, not as a whole as a church, but like you just forget about it or you don't think about it yet. And then you wonder why. And then you realize that that is the cause because they don't understand the impact or that they are appreciated. And then once you do, you're like, I would have done the same thing. And then you actually even realize like that you have done the same thing in the past.
Tell me what the future holds for Arab World Outreach. What's the reality of seeing physical churches in these countries?
So one of the things we were just discussing the other day was, are we a church planting organization or are we an organization that mobilizes Christians in these countries? And then on the back end, if there is a church that's planted, do we network with that person? Or do we come back on the end, since our goal is to work with Christians, those people who become believers, working with them to do that? And that's a kind of a small aspect of what we do. I feel like we can do one or the other. we can either learn how we can strategically engage and mobilize Christians in the Arab world, or we can focus on church planting. We did kind of make a shift recently where we're focused on that, but knowing on the back end that when we plant, that churches will come of this. If we actually obey Jesus and do what he's saying, there's something going to come up. There's going to be fruit that comes of it. And so if there are people who come to faith, what do we do with those people? How do we connect them to a local church? Is there a local church there? If there's not, what organization do we get to help network us to build a local church, or are we responsible for that? So when it comes to that, I think we're going to focus on Dearborn right now, and how we're engaging here and how we mobilize Christians in the community. And I think it's really strategic to get the churches to engage because they already have a connection to a church, and that's much more sustainable. But then when we go in these areas that don't have churches, that's going to be even more of a challenge. One of the challenges I think that happens in the Arab world specifically is, and this is going to sound really funny, but Christianophobia. We talk a lot about Islamophobia in the West, but there are news channels now in the Arab world talking about Christianophobia. The same fear that we have towards Muslims, they have towards us. So it's a mutual two-sided thing. So when we think about minorities being persecuted, that has been a common trend of any culture anywhere. And it's not just Christian minorities that are being persecuted. It's all minorities that are being challenged or not taken care of in the best of way. So like the governments just aren't. I mean, and most of the Arab governments are only 50, 60 years old because most of them were colonialized by the British and the French. So they're mostly pretty new countries and still decently unstable in some capacities.
How do you think that your organization is going to be most successful?
I want to break down any wall that is in the way from the message of Jesus pushing forward and Christians being able to love genuinely. For example, me trying to network with imams in the Arab world who will have genuine discussions about Christianophobia and these challenges that is actually impacting Christian communities, and us both together saying, hey, if you have our back, we'll have your back. Like, how do we then work together? And because the reality is, the best way to transform the Arab world is to change the culture directly. If there's problems with Christian persecution, how do you stop Christian persecution so that Christians can continue to do their work and share that message? So we want to face these things directly and openly and candidly. Yeah, you can use social media. There's tons of different things that, like, I mean, we use them in the West to change culture.
What would be your advice to anybody who is starting something like what you're doing that just seems so out of reach and yet is attainable?
Just take the first step. I think if we continue just to sit and think about it, we'll get overwhelmed by it, or we'll think about the impossibilities of it, or how this will pan out, or how we'll do that. But if we set up a mission in mind that we want to accomplish and start taking baby steps towards that, we'll begin to see how it can be easier and easier and easier. Like, for example, if we want to challenge the status quo in the Arab world for this type of stuff, I mean, that's talking to people I don't have connections with. That could potentially be political leaders.
Is there anything else that you think would be just vital for somebody that's listening to this?
One of the things I was thinking about, I actually just texted a pastor earlier about like what his number one challenge is or struggle. I think their church is somewhere between 100 to 200. And they're, I think, having trouble breaking that barrier. He said one of the challenges they're facing is volunteerism. And any pastor that I've talked to or things that we struggle with, I think we're all struggling with a similar thing. How do we get people involved or circled around the thing we're trying to talk about? And I think there's a few things that we have to learn to do. One is start telling compelling stories, and you need to have a clear call to action. And I know people hear that probably all the time, especially from organizations like you all, like when it comes to like maybe organizational clarity, if you're talking about Exana or Culture Bus or whoever these organizations are, like that's what they're all talking about right now. And I was awful at it. That was the number one reason we didn't have people jumping in and just throwing money our way to do this cause, because they didn't see it, they didn't feel it, they didn't know the tangible result. They didn't know that they could do a small amount like $10 a month. They just didn't see that they could tangibly make an impact and why they should. So we have to be compelling and we have to have a clear call to action. But another one is reproducibility, I think, is key. So if we're not discipling and we're not delegating things, even Jesus, like he had 12 disciples, and when the ministry got too large, he began to delegate and send them out. And even so you see a point where the apostles were sent out, and you see another point where the masses of like 72 were sent out. So there's these different stages of delegation. And then even in Acts, it talks about the deacons that were established to do a certain thing because the apostles didn't have time to do this certain type of work. And we wonder why we get to a point in ministry and we can't continue on, or we get burnt out, or we fall to the side, or we just give up and just stay at the same plateaued number that we're at right now. But we have to make disciples. I mean, that's what we're called to do. I mean, we're not just like failing at ministry by doing that, but we're disobeying Jesus. And so delegate those and make sure it's reproducible. Stop talking about stuff that goes over people's head. Because if it is, like we're talking about that on a Sunday morning, that's going to go over their head and they're not going to take it home with them. And it might have been good, but if they can't apply it directly right then and reproduce it in their life and share it with someone else, we need to make sure everything we're doing is reproducible. And then also the third thing is we need system structures and processes in place to make those things scalable and possible to grow. Most pastors are still, they might not have a database where they keep all the contact information. That's very dynamic. It talks about people's skill sets and interests and these types of things so we can connect them to different, I don't know, whatever the direct end is, we need systems to help move the masses in that direction.
And systems too also includes digital giving. Would you be able to do what you're doing right now if all you relied on were cash and checks?
Yeah, I would not. I would spend all of my time doing that and wouldn't be able to do as much ministry.
So why do you think churches are so, their mindset, there are so many that we talk to that still do cash and check?
Well, I never carry cash with me. If they want to get money from me, if I did go to a church, and I absolutely love the church, like I'm going to like adjust to it personally. But a lot of people aren't going to adjust to it if you don't make it as easy as possible. Like, for example, when we say we want to help people, that means making it as easy as possible, even if it's challenging. Mm-hmm. So we take that challenge, we make it just like, it might be a challenge for someone to give generously in their finances, but now you're making it even harder for a person to give because now they have to go to the bank to get that money to bring it on Sunday. And they're going to forget because they have so many other things. So we need to make it easy and accessible as possible. And if we don't start adapting to our culture or start asking new sets of questions on how to move forward, we're going to be left behind. Mm-hmm. And the culture is going to move on and the church is going to shrink unless people are going to come to know Jesus. If you're going through establishing a ministry, or if you're in ministry, know your why. Know why you do it. And keep that in front of you all the time, whether it's a wallpaper on your desktop, or if it's like on your background in your phone, or whatever it is. And don't give up. Just keep pushing forward. Even if you come to a halt or a standstill, don't say, well, this isn't possible. Look at it from a new perspective and figure out, get consultants around you. Don't be cheap. Like, hire a consultant and get them in front of your face so they can tell you stuff that works, that really works, because other people have gone through this struggle too, and they've found those people. So just keep persevering and keep your why in front of you.
Do you think that there's a pride factor in a lot of pastors anymore? I mean, millionaires have mentors. They have coaches. Do you think that there's pride that stops them from reaching out to coaches to help them?
I think there's pride, but then also I think we have these two things where we have the church has a poverty mentality, where we think we're like, we have to be in poverty for the rest of our lives as believers. So then that goes over into all of our other ways we live our life. So we're not as prone to be proactive or looking ahead at things. But then also we think we have to be separate. Like, we take that verse about being separate from the world, then we take it to the extreme. We think, well, we can't adapt just because the world said it can't, doesn't mean we should do it. But the reality is, like, Jesus was very contextual. He incarnated his self into flesh so we could relate to it. Our ministries need to follow likewise.
Still hungry for more? Head to onebigchurch.com to create a free profile and gain access to resources shared by top leaders from all across the country. Or you can always go to our Facebook page at One Big Church.